Not yet realizing Pitt and Birch's intent, Second Officer McFerrin, who had struggled down from the bridge and reached the stern with a bullhorn to help in calming the passengers, called out across the water,
"To the ship off our stern, do not come any closer. There are people in the water."
Pitt snatched his own bullhorn and shouted back, "Understood. Our boats will pick them up as fast as possible. Stand by. We're going to approach and tie next to you. Please have your crew ready to take aboard our lines." McFerrin was astonished. He couldn't believe the Numa captain and crew were willing to risk their own lives and ship in a daring rescue attempt.
"How many can you take on board?" he inquired.
"How many have you got?" Pitt asked back.
"Over 2,000, up to 2,500.
Birch groaned.
"We'll sink like a rock with 2,000 people piled on the decks."
Pitt shouted back to the officer on the deck,
"Other rescue ships are on the way. We'll take all if we can. Have your crew drop lines so your passengers can descend to our deck."
Birch smoothly worked the propulsion controls, moving his ship slowly forward, then manipulating the bow thrusters with a deft hand, swinging his ship toward the liner inches at a time. Then came the scraping sound of steel against steel. 30 seconds later, the two ships were firmly lashed together. Hawsers were passed over by the survey ship's crew, while the cruise liner's crew uncoiled lines and threw them over the sides, their ends trailing into the waiting hands of the scientists who hurriedly tied them to any object that held firm. The instant all lines were secure, Pitt shouted for the Emerald Dolphin's crew to begin lowering the passengers.
"Families with children first," McFerrin shouted through his bullhorn.
The old tradition of women and children first was commonly ignored by modern seamen in favor of keeping families intact. For a while, the evacuation seemed to be going efficiently, without bottlenecks. But as the fire came closer, the heat intensified, and the fumes made it difficult to breathe. The crowd turned back into a frightened mob. Suddenly, there was a mad rush by those who decided to take their chances in the water rather than wait their turn to shimmy down the lines to safety. They fell like rain, colliding with those already floating in the water. Several miscalculated and dropped onto the deck of the deep encounter, sustaining major injuries or dying on impact. Others fell between the ships and were crushed to death when the wave action pushed the hulls together. The Emerald Dolphin's crew did their best to instruct the passengers on how to jump. To strike the water with their arms over their head meant the impact would tear the life vest over their heads, leaving them to stay afloat on their own. Those who did not grasp the collar of the life vest and pull down upon impact ran the risk of breaking their necks. Before long, a small sea of dead bodies was drifting into the debris alongside the two ships. Kelly was scared. The little survey ship looked so close, yet seemed so far. There were only 10 people ahead of them on one of the lines attached to the vessel below. Suddenly, a heavy man with red hair and a mustache that stretched across his cheeks to his sideburns emerged from the human surge and tried to snatch Dr. Egan's leather case from his hands. Initially stunned, the engineer managed to hold onto the case in a death grip and refused to release it. In horror, Kelly watched the struggle between the two men. An officer in an immaculate uniform stood watching with what seemed total indifference. He was a black man with a face of hardened obsidian, his features chiseled and sharp.
"Do something!" Kelly screamed at him. "Help my father!"
But the officer simply ignored her, stepped forward, and to Kelly's astonishment, began to help the red-haired man in his struggle for the leather case. Pushed by the combined physical force of the two men, Egan lost his balance and pitched overboard headfirst. Startled by the unexpected movement, the black officer and red-haired man froze, then melted back into the crowd. Kelly screamed and looked down just in time to see her father strike the water with a huge splash. His head rose to the surface. His life vest was gone, having been torn from his body by the impact. His head dipped forward and rolled listlessly. Suddenly, Kelly felt hands around her throat, squeezing relentlessly. She frantically kicked backward while attempting futilely to pull the hands from her throat. In what was a lucky thrust, her foot caught the attacker in the groin. There was a sudden intake of breath, and the pressure on her throat was relaxed. She spun around and saw that it was the black officer again. Then the red-haired man pushed the black man out of the way and launched himself at Kelly. But she clutched the collar of her life vest, leaped clear of the railing, and dropped into the void, just as the red-haired man reached out for her. Down she plunged in an explosion of bubbles as the sea closed over her. She stroked upward, helped by her life vest, before she finally burst into the air. She sucked in several deep breaths as she looked around for her father and saw him floating limply about 30 feet away from the scorched hull of the cruise ship. She frantically swam to him, put one arm around his shoulders, and pulled back his head by the hair.
"Dad!" she cried.
Egan's face was twisted, as though he was in great pain.
"Kelly, save yourself," he said haltingly. "I can't make it."
"Hold on, Dad," she encouraged him. "A boat will pick us up soon."
Still clutching the brown case, he pushed it toward her.
"When I fell in the water, I struck this. I must have broken my back. I'm paralyzed and can't swim."
A body floating face down drifted against Kelly, and she fought to keep from gagging as she pushed it away.
"I'll hold on to you, Dad. We can use your hand case as a float."
"Take it," he muttered, forcing her to grab the case. "Keep it safe until the proper time."
"I don't understand."
"You'll know."
He barely got the words out, his face contorted in agony, and he sagged.